Okay, welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Jacobs Podcast. My guest today is Jack Watts. Jack is the CEO of the Bastion Collective, a full-service comms and marketing agency based in Sydney and Melbourne, with offices in LA and Shanghai. And today we're going to cover experience, risk, avoiding bad decisions, managing people, and so on. Jack, welcome to the Jacobs Podcast.
Thank you, Sean. Thanks for having me.
No dramas. Now, I know I've been talking about this episode for a little while, and so I'm glad we've finally secured a time to actually sit down and do it. Now, full disclosure, we had first met in China, so over a decade ago on a leadership summit, and I think one thing about our friendship is over the years, we've always checked in with each other in different stages or different points in time with sort of long gaps and short gaps sometimes in between, but you know, one thing that each time we've checked in, I've seen Bastion grow dramatically from, I remember it was just sort of an idea or concept you were telling me about, to just, really seeing a lot of growth. And it was very impressive. And I just wanted to get you on to talk about that sort of thing and all those things I mentioned at the headline there about risk, experience, managing people and all those sorts of things. But probably the first question I just wanted to start out with is, why did you start Bastion yourself or grow it on your own with your family? It seems kind of it's the reverse to, you know, what most people do. It's probably a process I'm going through at the moment, is first working for an organization and then starting something. It just seems like it's the reverse way most people, especially most young people, go about things.
Well, in short, Sean, I was needed a job and was borderline unemployable. I had a life's plan to play professional football, which turned out I wasn't good enough. And then all through university, I had this scholarship in mind I wanted to do in the UK. Turned out I wasn't good enough for that either. So I spat out of university on the other side, having never thought about getting a job and with bills to pay. And so I got referred into a couple of my first clients who needed some help selling sports sponsorship, mostly surfing events. I liked sport. Sales seemed to be something that was vaguely suited to me, so that was it.
Excellent. It's kind of interesting because I didn't realise that. I mean, well, I think if you look at the characteristics, though, of what, you know, how you started things, it probably didn't point to, you know, starting out by yourself, I guess. You know, I know other people who'd sort of persist and try to sort of find a position in a business, or they wouldn't sort of look at starting their own thing. It just sort of, that's kind of interesting.
Well, we've been going almost 10 years now, Sean. We've got a couple hundred staff in Australia and about another 20 in the US. Would be Australia's largest independent agency, and I can talk more about how the marketing and communications world works later on, but we've only really worked out who we are and what we do and why we do it in the last handful of years, I reckon. The genesis of the business was that I got a couple of gigs selling sports sponsorship out of the back of a Holden Commodore station wagon, pretty much. My brother was playing professional football. He spat out the other side, same deal, no job. He started a marketing agency. So I was working out of his office. He started a marketing agency called Bastion. So I started working out of his office. And we sort of grew it from there together. I grew the sponsorship arm of the business. He grew the creative arm of the business. And, fast forward 10 years and, as I said, a couple of hundred staff, and work across the range of communications disciplines.
Incredible.
Across creative, research, sponsorship, events, video production, PR, corporate comms. So in answer to your question, Sean, it's never like we 10 years ago, you start with this business plan that you got it all mapped out. We fumbled our way through it because basically the alternative of getting a real job never seemed that appealing. So it was just keep following, going down the rabbit hole and seeing where we ended up.
Excellent. Well, maybe just touch on quickly, just if listeners and even myself, like how sports sponsorship actually works. Is there a sort of a basic or layman's understanding to it, other than seeing lots of dollar signs and big contracts signed?
Yeah, so sports sponsorship is my background, but it's probably only 10% of what we do now. But it's the commercials of sport everyone sees how much players do or in some cases don't get paid. But the function of what they do get paid is typically a function of mostly what broadcast rights deal you can do. You know, there's a reason why AFL and NRL players get paid the most because they get big broadcast deals. Same with why NBA and EPL players get paid the most because they do mammoth broadcast deals, not just in America or the UK where those sports are located, but all through Asia predominantly. Then it's corporate sponsorship, membership, ticketing, merchandise, all those different revenue lines. So there's a lot to the commercials behind sport that you wouldn't really see on your TV screen on a weekend.
Yeah, super interesting, and I think that might be a future episode in there just by itself, because I do find that area fascinating. I don't think a lot of people sort of understand broadcast rights, because it can be a little bit confusing, but I mean, especially how it relates to sports sponsorship to individuals too, it's pretty fascinating.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the things, you mentioned some of the figures there, you know, employing hundreds of people, you've got multiple offices, and, you know, just seeing that growth has been pretty impressive. And, you know, in my own professional world, when I've sort of had a lot of, you know, doing major events, for example, at the G20 and Comm Games, and when you've got to manage lots of people and sort of sometimes hit the ground running. And, you know, you're still a young man as well. And obviously being a CEO, you're the final decision maker in a lot of respects. How do you go about managing people that are older than you?
I think that, well, that was one of my major issues in the early days, Sean. And it wasn't just about managing people older than me. It was about what I believed about my age. Now, I'm 31 now, and we've been going 10 years. So I was, call it 22, when we started. And we weren't always the business we are today. But nonetheless, it was, you're only successful in business if you start employing people that are a hell of a lot smarter than you. And in my case, everyone was older than me. I'm probably still one of the least experienced people in the business. And I always had this stigma around my age and why would anyone take me seriously? Both our staff, but also our clients. You know, I was advising a lot of CEOs on their marketing investments, you know, investing millions of dollars. And always in the back of my mind, you'd have this nagging thought of, I can hear the words coming out of my mouth and they all make sense. It seemed very rational. But in the back of my mind, you're going, why the hell is anybody taking me seriously?
Yeah.
It's like someday, and I feel like a lot of people have this imposter syndrome where you go, someday someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and go, hey, mate, we've worked it out. The gig's up. We know you're a fraud. Get the hell out. But it was sort of just at a zenith of my anxiety about my age and experience. I just came to a point where I was like, I'm either going to get over this or I'm not. And it's inhibiting me and the business being successful. So at one point, I just managed to put it behind me and realize that I'm just going to do the best, make the best decisions with the information I have in any given time. And if I make the wrong ones, which I've made a lot of, I'll deal with it and make the best decision at the next time with the information I have then.
I think, you know, one of the things actually I was listening to the other day on a separate podcast with Ryan Holiday, who's the American writer, a best-selling author, and he talked, and he's a pretty young guy as well, enjoyed a lot of success in his 20s, much like yourself, Jack, but he was saying, like, you know, a lot of things are made a lot easier if when you sort of work out that everyone's kind of winging it. And you know, it's not to say that it's, you know, no one knows what they're doing out there, but I think, you know, there's a lot of truth in that, and that imposter syndrome is something I've heard, you know, before. But it's interesting, like, you've had to put that behind you and just sort of double down. And I think you can look at things, you know, be confident, of course, in what you've grown and created. And, you know, 10 years too isn't exactly a small amount of time to be working on something. So it seems like there's a bit of confidence that comes with just being on the grind or on the job for a decade.
Definitely. And the sooner you realise that, like you said, nobody out there really knows what they're doing. In fact, there are people out there that know what they're doing. And they're the people who've been doing the same thing for the last 20 years. I don't want to be one of those people.
Yeah.
You know, doing the same thing for 20 years. My job changes every 6 months in terms of what it looks drastically different every 6 months. So it's the sooner you realise that everybody out there, your role models, your idols, your mentors, they've got no idea what they're talking about. They're just doing the best they can with the information they've got. You start to get a little bit more confidence.
Definitely. Now, we talked a bit about, of course, we touched on the growth of things, but we just talked briefly about the plan and, you know, like not having a sort of sticking to the plan, I guess, sometimes, and things fold and change and morph. And you've got a lot of initiatives going on, it seems. Like Bastion's quite a busy company in terms of when you look at it from the outside to see all these initiatives going on. Like, how do you actually keep across things? Is there any sort of ritual that you kind of follow or stay track of, you know, what's important to you?
Well, I'll give you the, I'll start at the broadest possible macro level, Sean, on the industry we're in. So the marketing industry, like most industries, has four big players: WPP, Publicis, Omnicom, Dentsu. There's a couple others you'd throw in there, but they're all international owned companies out of the UK, France, Japan, wherever else, and they've bought up all the Australian businesses. But some of the ones you may have heard of, Singleton's, which John Singleton ran with a couple of other guys, it was called STW, Mitchell's, which Harold Mitchell ran in Melbourne, that Dentsu bought. So there's these big multinationals, and then there's thousands and thousands of small marketing agencies that do PR or advertising or media buying, but there's very little in the middle. And so what we are is a collection of those small businesses that we've either grown or acquired that work together as one big agency that sits in the middle as the sort of big independent in the market. So our whole business is trying to be the best of both worlds, to have the service and expertise of the small agencies with the scale of the big agencies and proposition ourselves to clients. So there's probably 10 different parts to our business. And going back a step, what I said before is we never really had a business plan that lasted more than a couple of months, is that to get to those 10 different parts of our business, we've had to make so many mistakes, you know, failed ventures overseas, businesses we bought that didn't quite work out, different things we've gone into that were the wrong thing, people which were the wrong people, stuff that at one point was the biggest part of the business. Now you go, well, that's not quite our core business. We need to start to divest that. So once we got a good idea of where we were going in the last few years, it started to become a little bit more self-explanatory of the things we should and shouldn't be in. But we've also managed to implement a much better governance process. You know, the beauty of the business was it's majority owned by myself, my brother and my father, which means you can make a decision really quickly. But that started to, as we grew, that started to stand against us because we'd be making decisions too quickly.
Sure.
Not so considered, not so thought out. So I've been through a process of actually putting in steps to make a decision. So we're not just going in a million different directions, making a decision over text at 11 p.m. at night or sitting around the dinner table somewhere. So we're just trying to get good governance to be able to stay across what's, a hell of a lot of revenue coming through the business, a hell of a lot of clients, a hell of a lot of people. And also just try and get good people you trust. I mean, if you've got the right people running each business, you can have 100 of them because they hit their targets every month, they report in, deal with their issues, and on you go. But it's when you start to have problems that your scalability suffers, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We'll just touch on that, start to have problems in a second and a bit more on lessons learned. But it's interesting what you say about the governance process, and, you know, there's a lot of benefits to having, you know, your dad and your brother, and then, like you said, making sort of quick decisions. But then, you know, just working in, being, you know, working in government for as long as I have now, you know, you do see the, I guess, the benefits of having a cabinet process or a decision-making process, and how important, you know, these things have been over time to, I guess, not just running a business and a complex one at that, in your case, Jack, but, you know, a country or a state or even a city, and just, how important that governance process is and arriving at, you know, managing disagreement, of course, which is a lot of what politics and public life, I think, is all about. But, yeah, just sort of, again, like you said, not having those sort of rash decisions to take place, but more considered and more thought out approaches to different things.
I think that's right, Sean. And as we've got bigger, There's been a couple of constants is that as you get bigger, the problems get bigger, the stakes get higher, and the problems are more complex. The thing about being the CEO of a business is you're the final decision maker, and you only get the problems that come to you are the problems that nobody else has been able to solve. If they were easy problems, they don't get to you because they've already been solved through your management structure. So the stuff that you deal with, or I deal with all day, are the problems, are the most complex problems that have the highest stakes or the biggest impact if you get them wrong. And so, yeah, the bigger you get, you know, running a business or a listed entity or a country, the sort of better your governance process has to be, because the cost of getting it wrong is much higher.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's something that you always try to, you know, I guess as a policy advisor or working in government, you always want to try and sort stuff out at the most appropriate level possible. And then, you know, what I've found is over my career so far is just being able to have an instinctive feel about where a decision needs to go. And I think, you know, that's just that's something that when I started out my career, I just was always like, oh, you know, how do people know who needs to see what and what needs to go where? And it's just that time spent around, I guess, decisions. But I think one of the things you mentioned before about sort of lessons learned and learning from mistakes, and as you said, Jack, that's when you sort of start to have problems. What are sort of some of the key lessons you've learned in the process of growth? Are there sort of things that you sort of remind yourself all the time, or is it come back to that kind of instinct of, you know, what works and what doesn't? Do you ever, you know, do you maybe just talk a bit about that, Jack?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's lots of things you learn through the journey and then unlearn because they stop being relevant, and then learn them again the hard way. But there's a guy was involved in our early business, in the early days of the business. He always used, when I used to go and pour my heart out about the problems of the day I was having and where I was struggling, he'd always draw on a napkin for me this graph. And, you know, that week would be up and down, up and down, up and down. But when you zoom out the graph, it looks like one straight linear line. And his thing was always get a sense of perspective, zoom the graph out, because the graph's going up and up and up. And when you look over a year or 2 years or 5 years, you go from A to B and it looks like a very smooth journey. The reality is week by week, it couldn't be, it's anything but that. It's so drastically up and down as you have triumph and disaster. So I think as hard as it is, and I don't do it well at all, I'm not a role model for anyone here, because I lose sense of perspective daily. But if you can sort of try and zoom out the graph and see the bigger picture and realize the direction you're heading in and not just the fires you're putting out today. So that would be one. And then, you know, the only other thing I'd say for anyone who's starting or running their own business is, you know, there comes a point where you realize it's your mortgage on the line, and you absolutely try so hard to do the right thing by everybody, but your first, second and third priority is your family and making sure they've got the roof over their heads and the meal on the table. And in the end, that's got to be in the forefront of your mind, because the risk can be high, you know, if you're running your own business. The upside's high, but the risk is also high. So that's what I found. As long as you keep a sense of perspective and your priorities in the right order, then hopefully you're okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that sort of the napkin approach of, you know, the graph and seeing the squiggly line and then zooming out and, you know, applying a sense of perspective there. I remember my mentor, the first proper sort of mentor I had, sort of, remember we were talking about me taking a secondment or something like that, and I was sort of half in, half out, and he's just like, look, you know, whatever it was going to be, like 2 to 6 months out of a 50-year career isn't going to, you know, break the bank or be, you know, when you sort of take that sense of perspective, it's not such a huge thing. And I really like that bit of advice, because I think it's, you know, it's a principle you can apply to a lot of different things, and in your case, you know, grinding away. But then I guess that sense of perspective lends this idea to, you know, like you'd hope there's an upward trajectory or line in there somewhere, which in your case, Jack, has I think, you know, turned out pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Now, what about maybe just another quick question, actually, Jack, on, you know, mistakes. And I think, you know, have you sort of seen, I guess, people, you know, have you offered advice or anything like that to people, or have you seen people in your own case make, you know, pretty bad mistakes and go off on a wayward path, you know, in terms of dealing with that growth? Are there sort of just probably thinking about in an inversion, is there things like not to do when, you know, like thinking about lessons learned?
Well, we've made just so many mistakes over the journey. But in the really aggressive growth on our business, you're making bets all the time. Yeah, bet you wouldn't imagine making. If you're a punter on the weekend, like I'll labour over $5 each way or $10 each way. But Monday to Friday, I'm betting hundreds of thousands of dollars on different things we're doing. So it's some of those bets have gone wrong, but a lot of them have gone right. So I think it's trying, it's when the writing's on the wall that that bet's going wrong or it's going to be a failure, fail fast and get the bad news out fast. We've hung on to businesses you knew weren't going to go right for 1 or 2 years too long, hoping they'd come good. Whereas deep down, you know they're not going to come good. And so for mine, it's have a crack at everything, but fail fast, cauterize it, get the bad news out, and as honest as you can possibly be, overshare the bad news, and then move on with your life on the bets that are working, if that makes
Yeah,
sense.
look, I like that actually. That's really good. The now just a couple of short ones to wrap up. First one, do you have any role models, Jack? I know you mentioned a friend of yours that was sort of with the napkin, and he sounds like a bit of a role model. Is that the case?
I think whether you're subbing the word, Sean, role models or mentors, I've had sort of rolling 6 monthly to 12 monthly mentors, where I've lived in that person's pocket for 6 months, seen them every month, followed them up, read the books they told me to read, followed up the things they told me to follow up. And then I've always found that I've never been able to, they've been, short love affairs, if that makes sense. They've been 6 or 12 months. You're infatuated with each other. You meet this person for a cup of coffee. You're meant to be there for half an hour, and he or she is kicking you out the door after 3 hours because you don't want to go because you're learning so much. So I think for mine, it's mentors and a lot of them, and blatantly asking for it. The thing about mentoring is, and I've mentored a couple of people through the journey, and people don't follow you up, and oh, I don't want to take too much of your time. It's like, hang on, if I'm mentoring you, you set the agenda, you tell me where to be, you do all the work as the mentee, and the mentor shows up, imparts wisdom, leaves again. So I've found that critical, personally and professionally, to have the right mentors or role models. And plenty of them, because you haven't but different things in your life, personal, relationship, professional. And I've found that to be exceptionally helpful.
Excellent. Now, with politics, do you pay much attention to politics in your work or the what government's actually doing or even interacting with the government much?
So when you add our various government contracts up, they'd be a very big client, but it comes in 100 different tenders or RFPs or otherwise. So always got a very close eye on the government of the day, state, federal or local, and what they're doing. You sort of need to know the narrative in government because all the staffers within government departments know that so intimately. And I'll say that more broadly is you got to read what your clients are reading. Most of my clients are reading the Fin Review or the Australian Business, so that's what I sort of pretty religiously read, because you got to know the things that they bring up, or you got to bring up the things that you're anticipating they're reading. So take a pretty deep interest in all that stuff. I find I can do it on the weekends if I read all the weekend papers. When I've got a bit more time, I can sort of skim through the rest during the week.
That's I really like that bit of advice. Read what your clients are reading. It's a It's a good one. Do you read many books at all, Jack, as well, or is it just sort of trying to the business weeklies and all that and the Fiend and stuff, or do you have time for books as well?
Yeah, I try my hardest, and I liked your first podcast on which books you're reading, Sean.
Oh, thanks for
because
listening.
It's always hard to find the right one. No, no worries. I find I'm no good on books during normal work hours or just a normal work week. I find I can read, knock over one or two in a holiday when I'm sort of disconnected a little bit. But I find it really hard to read more than 3 or 4 pages a night before I want to just fall asleep.
Sure.
So probably maybe 10 books a year, but really enjoy the ones I do and wish I read more.
That's excellent. Still, 10's a pretty good effort, especially given how busy you are, Jack. Now, any further tips or thoughts for young people? And there's been some really good ones that have sort of come out of the interview, but maybe for people looking at starting a business, and perhaps, you know, it might be even advice that you would have given yourself 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think for someone starting a business, and I've done it the wrong way around, but it's sort of get an idea of the life you want to live and work towards that. You know, if you want a really flexible life with lots of time for your family, then build a business around doing that. You might not have that flexibility in the first handful of years, but if you build your business appropriately, you'll build towards it. If you want a lot of money, if money's important to you, and that's okay, then build a business that's extremely profitable. So I'd say that is number one, and yeah, sort of understand what's important to you and your family and work back from there. And number two is a pretty simple one, but it's sort of never lose the thrill of the chase. The base line of what you got in it for. You know, I had dinner with a really successful entrepreneur once who sold caravans for a living, and he's gone on to do hundreds of other things wildly successfully. And I go, asked him what kept him going, what's the one thing he loves doing, and he goes, you know what, selling caravans. It's just being on the lot, seeing someone come towards you and trying to make the sale. So it's just like the baseline of why you got in it in the first place. It's very easy to lose track of that because things get complex, and you know, the bigger you are, the more people issues you have or client issues you have. But the sort of thrill of whatever it is, whether it be winning a pitch or delivering something world class or seeing people grow, whatever it is that really got you in it in the first place, do more of that because that's the stuff that will keep you in it.
I really like that point too about, you know, you mentioned before about if you're mentoring someone, setting the agenda and, you know, like them coming to you with what they want. And I think a lot of that grows from, and having mentored a lot of uni students as well, it really comes back to just what you said then, Jack, about getting an idea of what you want to have. And, you know, that's something that's hard to kind of work out when you're younger. But one of the things that came out of my book, because I'm sort of looking at doing a bit of mentoring, like a mentoring kind of program out of my book, Winners Don't Cheat, is, you know, the principle that, and I just distilled all the principles down in each chapter, and there's probably like three, you know, two in each out of the 20 chapters. But what it kept coming back to then was exactly what you said, Jack, is like getting an idea of what you want to have and sort of designing accordingly or planning accordingly. And I think that that is something a lot of, you know, young people in particular just sort of don't take the time out to actually kind of work out themselves or do some serious thinking about, you know, what, where their talents might apply, but what kind of life they want to have, and, you know, whether it's the thrill of the chase or whether it's something else.
Yeah, I think that's right. And when you get into the lives we all lead where you're sort of onto one thing to the next and very little downtime because your email's in your pocket and the next phone call and the next this and the next that, and you sort of, I don't know about you or anyone else, but I've really sort of, when I drive home, evaluate my day. Like, was I efficient enough today? Did I do enough today? And realistically, once the stakes get a little bit higher, you can get great value out of nothing. And that's hard to justify to yourself. That, what did you do today? Well, I really didn't achieve anything, but I thought about a lot of stuff, and I didn't get an outcome, but I cleared the space in my brain that in a week's time or a month's time or a year's time, I'll have that amazing idea or life-changing thought because I cleared the space out, if that makes sense. So it's sort of very hard to, you know, I think we all try to justify what you've done today or yesterday or what you can do in the next hour. And it's very hard to put a value, attribute a value to doing nothing or just thinking. And, you know, that's what gets you that time and space to go, what do I really want? And how can I build that for myself and my family?
Yeah, absolutely, Jack. And it's interesting too, we guys, the gents I do the podcast with, typically Jordan, Shopov and Will and his brother Al, we sort of compare notes on email a fair bit. And this is exactly what we're talking about recently about you know, the feedback loop and giving yourself space and time. Because it is one of those key elements of deliberate practice and getting better is you got to give yourself feedback. And it's all very well to just sort of keep running hard at things and different problems. But if you're not taking that time out as you do to just switch off and think hard about what have I done that's good, what have I done that's, you know, I could improve on, you know, that's something I pay a fair bit of attention to. But it's something that's really needed to get better and improved. And it's interesting too, Jack, how you do that with switching off as well and clearing space and time. Do you find it hard to do that? Like you say, in your emails and your pocket and stuff, do you take time out other than on your drives home? Is there any sort of rules you follow to defrag or, you know, go, you know, no tech or anything like that?
Yeah, I just find that I'm better off without my phone at certain times. It's like, yeah, I typically go for a swim or walk the dog every morning and sort of now religiously leave my phone at home. And also when I get home past whatever's a reasonable time to still be taking phone calls, probably 6:30, try to leave my phone in the bedroom and just not touch it and check back in at 9 or 9:30, see if there's anything urgent I've missed it. Otherwise, leave it till the next morning. So try to do it that way. And I don't know about you, I just get this feeling, like this icky feeling that I've just like held my phone for 8 hours today and I've unlocked it about 800 times.
Yeah.
It just feels like sickening that I've been so attached to this thing in my hand all day.
Yeah.
And I'm getting dumber as a result.
The more you stare at it. Well, actually, you know, you and I, I'm just a bit older than you, only a tiny bit, of course. But it's, you know, I remember when we had days, it's times without the smartphones, and that was sort of an interesting era, but you kind of just forget to, you know, like if you catch up with people or sit around or you're constantly looking at your phone of just that life before having a phone. And it's sort of, yeah, just is an interesting time, but lots of younger people coming through now have never sort of grown up without having that constant phone and the, like the email in the pocket, as you say.
Yeah, that's right.
The now, what's next for you, Jack, and the business? You mentioned sort of things change every 6 months, and I do dare say there's a lot of thrill in the chase and all those sorts of things, and you've designed something pretty well, and I think you should have a lot of success that you should be really proud of. Is there anything on the horizon in particular you want to share or what's next?
Yeah, plenty next for Sean, personally and professionally. I mean, we're on a journey work-wise. We think we've got an opportunity to create the Great Australian Communications Agency, and that once existed in this country with some of the names I've mentioned, John Singleton, Harold Mitchell, and a lot of others in the sort of halcyon days of the 80s and 90s in advertising communications. And it's now dominated by multinationals. So we think we've got an opportunity to do that, be that Australian-owned leader in the space and build a communications agency that changes the way this country thinks about itself and the way brands talk to their consumers and the way consumers consume advertising and media. So we think we've got that opportunity, and on a broader scale, we think we can replicate that globally. We can think we can build a agency business built largely on Australian values and take that model to the world, which we're trying to do in the States and Asia at the moment. So that's professionally, and that's hard to commit to a vision like that, Sean, because it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow.
Sure.
But, you know, we're on a path to create that, and you know, we've got a good plan to do it. Personally, my wife's 4.5 weeks away from having our first child. So
wonderful. Congratulations.
All those things. Thank you. All those things about building the life you want to leave. Amazing the different perspective I've had on work in the last 6 months. It's sort of like, well, I've got to build something a little bit more sustainable. If I need to do whatever you got to do with a kid, and I don't even know what you got to do at this point. I'll find out pretty quickly, I think. be able to commit to a family life and go and achieve that vision we've set at work as well.
Sure, and I think that's you've got the right principles, Jack, and to absolutely do that. Jack Watts, that's been a really interesting and fascinating discussion, and I really enjoyed some of the principles you've shared with us there. Thanks for joining us on the Jacobs podcast, and I will put a link up to Bastion and any other things you want to send me in the show notes. But Jack Watts from Bastion Collective, thanks very much for joining us on the Jacobs podcast.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for tuning in to that episode with Jack Watts, CEO of the Bastion Collective. I really enjoyed that episode and some of the principles that Jack shared there. And if you did too, there are many more episodes like this on the podcast. So please go check those out at seanjacobs.com.au. The podcast is available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts as well, and a few other platforms. So please rate on whatever medium you listen to the podcast on. And of course, share with your friends and your networks as well. Thanks very much for listening, and until next time.